Welcome to Greatness, where the world's leading thinkers share their ideas about how to create greatness, great leaders, great teams, and great organizations. Why be good when you can be great? This is Gretchen Gagel, and I am incredibly excited today to welcome Kathy Oddie, Family Violence Lived Experience Consultant, to the Greatness Podcast. Welcome, Kathy.
Hi, Gretchen. I'm so happy to be here.
Kathy and I stumbled across upon each other on LinkedIn, and some of the audience may know that I had 5 wonderful years being president of a women's foundation where I, in Colorado, where I spent a lot of time advocating for women's issues. And it's a deep passion of mine. And I love bringing people onto the Greatness Podcast. We talk about great leaders, great teams, and great organizations. But one of the things about being a great leader is passion. And so, Kathy, I just was really grabbed by your passion. Could you share a little bit with our listeners about kind of your life journey, and how did it lead you to where you are today as a family violence lived experience consultant?
Absolutely. I can definitely share some of my story with you and your listeners. So I guess becoming an advocate is something, a journey I never really anticipated would happen in my life. It wasn't something I sought out, but it came directly as a result of becoming a victim survivor of family violence and sexual assault in my early 20s. My first abusive relationship lasted for 3.5 years and then was followed by 10 years of stalking. Within that relationship, I experienced all forms of abuse, severe physical, emotional, verbal, psychological abuse. And it was actually during that relationship, I was held hostage at gunpoint. I was burnt. I was punched. I was choked. It was just a horrific time that I had absolutely no prior experience of any of that type of abuse in my life. So it completely took me by surprise, and I didn't know how to deal with that. And so jumping forward to 2007, when I'd already was a couple of years out of the relationship, I was at a point where I was feeling, I guess, really quite let down and, to be honest, angry and frustrated mm-hmm. with the systems and services that I'd encountered when I was trying to seek help in my situation. I was constantly coming up against brick walls, whether it be to my local GP to disclose why I was being injured, to request help from the police, particularly like in that incident where I was being held hostage, trying to get protection through intervention order with my local magistrate's court. And everywhere I turned, it seemed like there were insurmountable barriers to actually getting the outcomes I needed. Mm. And I was never proactively being offered referrals to support services. By this stage, I hadn't ever been told that there was such a thing as a specialist family violence service, or been referred on to a counsellor or a psychologist to deal with the immense trauma that I'd experienced. It actually took me being raped by a stranger to finally get a referral for a counselling service. And it was through that and going through victims of crime assistance that I slowly started to become linked in with services. And that actually then made me realise how much I'd been let down in the space of being assisted around the family violence. And so in 2007, there was one of the free newspapers in Melbourne, is called the Leader newspaper, came into my letterbox, and it was advertising that a program from the Victorian statewide Safe Steps Family Violence Crisis Service were looking to recruit a group of women to train them to be able to do media interviews and challenge victim blaming myths and be able to tell our stories the way we wanted them told. And I thought, do you know what? This is exactly what I need at the moment, because they made it really clear. It's not a therapy group. If you need help with referrals to that sort of thing, we'll help that with you. But this is actually around changing the narrative and changing systems and services for better. I'm like, great, this is exactly what I want to do, because I need to channel all this energy that I'm having, which is actually harming me,
right,
and turn it around into changing my story for the better, but within that process also empowering and changing it for others. And that's now been the journey I've been on since 2007. And unfortunately, I then ended up in a second abusive relationship between 2010 and 2016, where yet again, went through all forms of abuse, but also quite severe financial abuse, which left me $50,000 in debt and resulted also in me losing a child. But the fact that I went through a second abusive relationship when I already was a family violence advocate, though at the time I was, you know, questioning myself and feeling like I was a phony because I was out there doing speaking engagements around family violence when I was yet again going through this stuff at home. But I think when I reflect on that now, it just goes to show how insidious family violence is, because even people who know about this, who work in this space, can still find themselves victim to these predators. So it's made me even more committed to the cause. And when you talk about how that it was my passion that sort of really sort of sparked that interest, well, it's a passion which has become a calling for me. And I'd have to say now this advocacy has become embedded into my DNA.
Yeah, that's so incredible. What courage it takes on has taken on your part to extricate yourself from the relationships, to dive into this advocacy training program, and to speak, as you're frequently speaking on these topics. So tell us a little bit more about what it's meant to become an advocate, like what that process and how that has given probably a little bit more power to your voice.
Well, like so many victim survivors of family violence, particularly when the first relationship ended, I found that my self-confidence, self-esteem was completely obliterated. I had completely withdrawn into myself, as is very natural, because as the nature of family violence is, you're controlled and isolated and set apart from your support systems of your family and friends. And so to think that I would eventually be speaking in front of large audiences or on the steps of the State Library doing a speech for the Reclaim the Night March would be a thing at that point for me that was completely inconceivable. As I said, it was really getting to that point of frustration of, if I'm someone who's from a situation of white privilege, I speak English as my first language. At that point in my life, I was working for Centrelink, so I was working within government systems, helping people who are actually going through family violence. And I was thinking constantly, well, if I'm finding it so hard to get help in my circumstances, how much harder would it be if I was experiencing any other barriers or challenges in my life to getting that equity of assistance, such as not speaking English as my first language or living with a disability, any of those additional things that can make it just that bit harder. And I honestly thought to myself, I found that I would have given up on so many occasions, but if there'd been anything else that had added to that list, I would have. And that's, I guess, why when this opportunity to join the Safe Steps Survivor Advocate Program came up, it was really important to me, not just in reclaiming my own voice, but also to creating that pathway of amplifying the voices of those in the minority groups who are particularly vulnerable, even more vulnerable than what I am. And so through this process of advocacy, it's not only changed my life, it's saved my life on many occasions, because the thing is, when you leave an abusive relationship, it's not like everything's suddenly all sunshine, lollipops and rainbows.
Right.
Yeah, wouldn't that be lovely? You're dealing with the messy process of healing and recovery, and also life continues to go on. And so for me, at points when I was going through those really black moments where I was getting sucked down into the black fog of depression or having an episode of PTSD, having this advocacy role helped me to be able to step outside of my own individual circumstance and think of the bigger picture. So what had started by doing the media interviews and helping with Inform on the creation of primary prevention resources actually has led on to being part of sitting on steering committees, doing consulting work. And what has been one of the most meaningful things for me happened in 2015 was when they announced Victoria's Royal Commission into Family Violence. And I felt incredibly compelled to put in a submission. I'd never written any type of submission before in my life, but I just thought, I'm going to just get this out of me. And I didn't even think about what might come next. I actually was then called to give my testimony to the Royal Commission. And honestly, when I reflect on that experience, it was simultaneously one of the best things I've done in my life and the most meaningful things I've done in my life, but also one of the hardest things. But to know that just by sharing some parts of my story, the result of that, that led on to two of the final 227 recommendations. And those two recommendations were 104 and 106. So 104, what that referred to was the healing and recovery supports for victim survivors, because the point that I was making to the commissioner on the day was that it doesn't just stop at point of crisis that you need help, that this journey for victim survivors is going to most likely be a lifetime journey, and we need to have access on an on-needs basis for the rest of our lives to trauma-informed specialists. And so that's what recommendation 104 is about, is supporting that point. And then recommendation 106 was in regards to victims of crime assistance. So in my journey, unfortunately, because of the different crimes that have been committed against me, I've had to go through Victims of Crime Assistance Tribunal, or VOCAT, three separate times. Once for rape by a stranger, once for family violence for the first perpetrator, and the final time was regarding an assault from a stranger. So it was actually the rape by the stranger, which was the first time I went through this, and it was through going through that experience that I was told I could actually apply under the family violence, because the reason that rape occurred was because I was too scared to go home that night because the perpetrator was waiting there. And he'd been stalking and harassing me. So I stayed in a circumstance which led to me being extra vulnerable. Anyway, so when I put in this these two claims, one after another, at the time the special financial assistance for rape was $10,000, and for family violence it was $1,000. And this is what I called out the Royal Commission. I said, look, this is such a judgment call that you're saying one thing is a lot more traumatic and impactful than another, and it's just not the case. A violent crime is a violent crime is a violent crime, but the message you're sending by having such a disparity, it really shows what you're placing in terms of the little value, or that you're saying that family violence is just not as serious, which in my case and for so many people's cases, that you're living that nightmare for years, and that nightmare doesn't end once the relationship ends. Yes, the rape was awful, traumatic, it's impacted me in so many ways, but the family violence was the worst situation. So the result of bringing that to the commission's attention was that they then recommended, with recommendation 106, that a complete review of VOCAT should occur. And that review has now been implemented. So that was the review of the Victims of Crime Assistance Act, which was tabled to Victorian Parliament in 2018. Jump forward to this year, I've been appointed by the Minister for Victim Support to the Victims of Crime Consultative Committee. And as part of my role of being a victim representative on that state government committee over the next 3 years is to actually oversee the implementation of the 100 recommendations that came from that review of the Victims of Crime Act. So that's a really full circle moment for me, which I can't even tell you how meaningful that is, to go from putting my lived experience out to seeing a review occur where all these other people got to put in their submissions of what their experience of going through the Victims of Crime claim process was like, and now to actually see that the whole process is going to change for the better.
That's so amazing. You should be very proud of what you've accomplished, Kathy. And I believe in serendipity. I think that people meet each other for a reason. 15 years ago, a very good friend of mine was running an organization that trained women as advocates. And it was my first experience in funding and supporting that. I actually did a radio show. Just popped into my memory with a woman we were fighting for, well, it was kind of tax policy, to put it simply. But yeah, you should be very proud of what you've accomplished. And I sense that you do have great pride. And you've said to me, it's a privilege to be an advocate. And I think that's commendable. What would you want our listeners to really understand? Let's dig a little deeper into the family violence issues. You know, our listeners out there are broad ranging and global. Mm-hmm. What would you like them to really understand from your lived experience around family violence?
What I would like people to understand is that regardless of where you may be in the world, that there is help out there. To not go through this experience feeling alone. I know when you're in the midst of the relationship that the nature of the psychological abuse and coercive control affects your brain to feel like that this lived reality almost becomes normalized. And it actually takes, in a sense, a while post-relationship to deprogram that distorted thinking. But I would say that that first moment where your gut instinct is shouting to you, this is not right, the way I'm being treated is against my core values, is those red flag moments. Listen to your gut instinct, because that is 100% right. Because when I reflect on my life and the abuse that I've gone through, it's those times when I did not listen to my, those red flags and take note of them, and kept thinking, oh, things will change, he'll get better, he's apologized. It doesn't change. It's like so many people who go through this, my experience was that the violence and abuse just continued to escalate through both of the abusive relationships. And I guess if I could speak to myself in my early 20s, when I just felt so lost and alone, I would say to that younger me that there are actually specialized support services who will believe you, who will understand the dynamics of what you're going through, who won't just use comments like, oh, boys will be boys, and normalize these behaviors, who won't laugh at you when your abusive partner is making derogatory comments about you in front of them, or jokes at your expense, that all those sort of warning signs that you can get out when it's still safe without having to wait. Because the thing is with family violence perpetrators, they don't start the relationship by punching you in the face. It's right. That... almost think about how pedophiles groom their victims. It's very similar to what women who are in abusive relationships also experience, because there's that the courtship, the romanticising of things. And so by the time that the more insidious abuse starts creeping in, you've already formed that attachment to that person. Because the thing is, you wouldn't fall in love with the monster. I mean, these guys, and also some women, we must acknowledge that, there also are women that are perpetrators, and also in LGBTIQ relationships, family violence exists as well. So this is not gender specific. However, we must acknowledge that overwhelmingly women and children are the victims of family violence and perpetrators are overwhelmingly male. However, the fact is that you're not alone in falling in love with this seemingly charming man. Both of my perpetrators were very much loved by their friends, family and community. Mm-hmm. On the outside, funny guys with a lot of charisma, but there was that Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde sort of element to both of them. And honestly, what in as well should have been the warning sign was their addictive personalities and their complex relationships with drugs and alcohol. They were people that the drugs and alcohol, I wouldn't say made them violent, because they were certainly violent and abusive when they were sober, but the drugs and alcohol intensified the violence incredibly. And so that's, for me, become a huge red flag for if I was to become in any future relationship, if I saw that someone had that sort of complex relationship with substances, I'd be walking in the other direction. So I guess my key message to anyone going through this is to look up what your local family violence services. There's generally going to be a national contact number, and the national contact number here in Australia is 1-800-RESPECT, and they can then find what the supports in your local area are. Alternatively, if you're in immediate risk, you'd be calling your local police. Here in Australia, it's 000. And on the flip side of this, if you're the friend or the family member or the colleague or the neighbour, you can play an active bystander role. Unfortunately, in my experience, I didn't have anyone who really stood up to my perpetrators when they were doing things in front of them. Like, I had times when my first perpetrator had me on the ground kicking me and no one intervened. Wow. So what I would say to particularly, like, when you, it's not about putting yourself at risk as the bystander, but it's if someone, like, you're seeing that the victim is clearly uncomfortable, like in that circumstance where there's those derogatory jokes being made, you can actually be that person that says, look, that's not really funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can call out that sort of disrespectful sexist behaviour, because a previous Prime Minister here in Australia made a comment to the effect of, no, not all disrespect leads to family violence, but all family violence starts with disrespect. And that's what I think we have to look at, is really nurturing respectful relationships across all aspects of our community, whether that's within our interpersonal relationships that are romantic, family, or in the workplace. But when you're out and you're seeing that someone is in distress and they're at risk, no, even if you're just standing in the vicinity to let that person who's going through this know that they're not alone, that there is a witness, there are so many things that you can do to play a role to help someone who is going through this. So I guess the key message would be, as a bystander, is to do something rather than nothing. People like to think that family violence is a private matter, but it's not. It's a very public issue, and it costs here in Australia our economy over $33 billion a year. So it affects every single one of us.
So such great information. And your journey around voice and advocacy. And, you know, maybe somebody out there is thinking, you know, I've had my voice suppressed and I'm over it. You know, yes. I'm ready to stand up and have voice. And it might not even be about family violence. I mean, being able to stand up about around our values. One of the things I'm teaching right now at the University of Denver is ethics and leadership. And how do you live by your moral compass, and how do you stand up with courage? So what have you learned about being an advocate, and what words of encouragement would you have for other people that are considering having that courage to become an advocate?
So the first thing that I'd recommend to someone looking to engage in advocacy on whatever the topic it is that they're passionate about is first check in about their own personal safety to speak out. Can they speak out using their own identity, or do they need to use a pseudonym? Mm. And given that there are a range of ways we can use our voice, it's looking to see what are the ways that someone actually feels comfortable to share their story and do advocacy. Maybe it might be as simple that they start off with sharing social media posts about issues that are important to them, as I'd say, is the sort of first tier on the rung. So that sort of sets out that signal to people, well, here's someone who actually cares about this stuff. And then you start building a community around that issue, because you're not a lone person that cares. You're then part of a movement. And then if you take it to the next point, that you're actually wanting to share your opinion. So then it may be that you, for example, on LinkedIn, you have the ability to write an article on there and post that. Then it gets to the point of I might wish to actually go out and do some public speaking on an issue. So am I going to be engaging with media? Am I going to be speaking to organisations or giving lectures? Or it may be that I just wish to anonymously put in a submission to a review on a particular topic that's coming up, like, for example, how I did with the Royal Commission. I could have just chosen to stay completely anonymous in that process, and I still could to this day never identify that I was part of that, because all throughout my submission I've got a pseudonym allocated. So safety first, looking at what are the methods that you want to deliver your information. Like, I love that these days that we've got podcasts as an option, and that there's such a plethora of people that really are engaging with this as a medium to learn about different issues. So, but it's also something that you could do anonymously if you wanted to. You don't have to start in your advocacy journey jumping straight to being like the public image and the public face about an issue. You can start in a really subtle way and start building your voice, building your community, link in with some of the other advocates in that space, because they can help support. Like, if you do a post, yet again we'll use LinkedIn as an example, because I find that in an incredibly safe space and supportive space, say compared to some of the other social media sites, that then if you've got people that are supporting your voice and sharing things that you post, then your voice is also building momentum.
Yeah, it's so great. When I moved to Australia 2 years ago, I belonged to a group in the US that also exists here in Australia. And it's such an incredible network of supportive women. I think looking for those support systems, and at my company Conversant, we talk about community. Like, how do you find your tribe? How do you find those people that are going to give you strength and be there to support you? So as we wrap up, Kathy, I really feel like I could talk to you forever about this. I do feel that, there's a reason that people run into each other on LinkedIn. What's next for you? Let's let our listeners know as we're wrapping up what's next on your journey.
Well, currently it's interesting that you bring up finding your tribe, because it's something that is also been able to help lift and sustain me through those difficult moments over the years, is finding my tribe of warrior women. But where I've had these strong female leaders who've given me a seat at the table or opened doors to different opportunities, right now I feel a strong commitment to paying that forward to others who are beginning on their advocacy journey. So that's something I've been doing a bit this year with people that have contacted me saying that they'd really like to start sharing their voice and their story. But aside from that, I guess I'm also trying to work on making my own transition from being seen as the volunteer to being seen as the professional and building my consultancy. And in what's been great, and that I recently was appointed into a senior governance role with Victoria Legal Aid Specialist Family Violence Court Project Steering Committee. So that is, I guess, another sort of step on the ladder to getting seen in that sort of leadership space, which is really meaningful for me, because often when you're coming from the voice of lived experience, what I've experienced over the years has been sometimes you're the ticker box exercise, and it becomes very tokenistic, the consultation that's had with you. Now, to be included as part of a governance role in a project, that actually says to me that this is an organisation that's walking the talk when they say that they're putting their clients first across all levels of their project plan and delivery, by putting, that you're not having power over, you're having power with. This is what I want to actually see other organisations do more and more, and also help encourage corporate community partnerships. But just to finalise up, my other sort of big dream item to have launched by the end of next year is a family violence victim survivor-led peak body / peer network, because that's a huge gap here in Australia that we don't currently have something for all the advocates in this space. And it's got to a point in our evolution as a movement that we need our own safe space to communicate as peers, and to really sort of look at the things that our shared challenges and our shared needs in this space as well.
Kathy, I have every confidence that you will accomplish anything that you put your mind to. And I really appreciate you taking the time to join the Greatness podcast. As I said, lifting up the voices of people who are standing up with courage, with passion, and leading. And you are leading in this space, and I commend you, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor to be invited on today. Thank you.
Interested in hearing more? Visit us at greatnessconsulting.com. Thank you.